This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the worlds of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or stream us live on YouTube and Bloomberg.com.
Energy markets, we've watched so closely this year thanks to the Russian war in Ukraine. I mean, it was one of the big unexpected events of the year. We know today we saw another round of Russian missiles really coming down on Ukraine, one of the biggest and heaviest barrages of the war. So we want to talk geopolitical, the impact on commodities and markets. We've got a great guest to do that. Ed Price is with us. He is principal for geopolitical forecasting at Ergo. It's a global consulting and forecasting firm. He's a former British trade official. And so much more. We welcome him here in our studio. Hey, Ed, good to have you here with the team. So how do you gauge the geopolitical events? Specifically, let's start with Russia and Ukraine. Do you think we get an end to this war next year? What are you telling your clients?
Thanks, Carol. So we're telling our clients right now that we're in a state of stalemate, meaning it does seem that this war has reached the sort of point that neither side can conquer the other, right? No, we don't expect Kyiv to march on Moscow, nor do we expect the opposite successfully, at least. But of course, this war has to end. It's not possible for this thing to keep carrying on in the way that it is. And so as you go through...
And yet it's gone on much longer than we all anticipated.
Which is kind of what we wanted after we sent those weapons, no? Hmm. I don't know, right? But at some point, we don't want that anymore. We want it to end.
Right.
And so I think what you have to do is take very seriously someone like Putin's threats of nuclear escalation. Hmm. Even if they are low probability, they have a very high potential risk outcome. So you have to watch them as asymmetric risks.
But what does an end look like here? Because right now, at least to the outside observer, there doesn't seem to be an opening. You have someone in Putin who doesn't seem like he's interested in negotiating. And for that matter, Volodymyr Zelensky has said the same thing. And you have a country in Ukraine that has been decimated, an economy that's been decimated. So even if Ukraine wins this war, and I put that in quotation marks, what does the future look like for them?
I think you're making a profound point here, because define win. Mm-hmm. Now, we're looking at Putin and saying he wanted to conquer the whole of the country. Maybe he did in period one. We're in period two. Mm-hmm. And now maybe he places some kind of premium on disruption itself, on carnage, on human destruction. You know, maybe a rule of thumb for one way that this war ends is which one of these presidents is assassinated first, right? The first one that gets a revolver to his head. Maybe it's Putin. Maybe it's Zelensky. That's a real dynamic. Again, low probability in each case.
Just a clear hypothetical here, though. Mm. If for some reason Putin was not there for whatever reason, is that a better scenario for Russia? I mean, are the people who would fill his shoes, are they any better?
That's a great point.
Do they have
question.
A different ideology?
Yeah.
I think anyone that fills Putin's shoes will be wearing Putin's shoes, right? To riff on your point, and will continue with this ideology of nationalism and militarism, indeed imperialism in Russia. That will continue. Is that good for the Russian people? No, right? It's not good for them at all. But if you mean, will someone else be more successful in the assault on Ukraine? Possibly.
Ed, I want to go back to your comment about nuclear weapons. Even though it's a low probability, the outcome would certainly be disastrous. What should the world do to prevent some sort of outbreak of nuclear war? Is that what you say a risk is?
Well, the outbreak of nuclear war is always a risk, right? I mean, growing up, we knew this, and it never went away. It was an illusion.
But it did sort of go away with the decline of the Soviet Union.
And the
strategic arms limitation treaty and, you know,
possibly
these sorts of things.
And yet there are stockpiles around.
there are, but the idea was mutually assured destruction.
Right.
But that wasn't true. It's actually, in fact, nuclear weapons that have now allowed Putin to go into Ukraine with such vim. Right. This is a new
Ukraine's threat. Lack of nuclear weapons, which it gave up in that original deal.
Correct.
Yeah. Absolutely correct.
So, Ed, what's the role of the developed world or the European allies, the United States in there? We know that they've already been, you know, understandably so, helping out the Ukrainians when it comes to weapons. So what is the role of the developed world, do you think, going forward? Do they continue to do that, or do they somehow help assist in maybe bringing some kind of conclusion here?
Well, again, we have assisted Zelensky to the point that it's maybe immaterial how long-range his weapons are if he can get right up to the border. Mm-hmm. We have assisted Zelensky rhetorically, materially, politically. That kind of depends on who's in the White House, right? So if I imagine that one of Putin's lifelines is what happens in 2024, there may well be another president, perhaps unmentionable, in the White House again. And at that point, all bets are off.
Hmm. Interesting. I do want to pivot from Russia to another geopolitical issue, and that involves China and Taiwan. There's obviously there's a lot we don't know, but a lot of speculation about China's ambitions when it comes to Taiwan, and more importantly, whether it's going to actually try to make good on that anytime soon.
Well, look, if China wants to use force, it will use force. The thing to think about is that twofold. One, China thinks in longer chunks of time, mm-hmm. so the when question is different. There's a lot of discussion in the American military and intelligence community about a five-year window, maybe. But that's maybe Xi Jinping's personal window. I'm not sure it's China's window. But it depends on how prickly Taiwan becomes. But then, two, I think people have something of a misconception about this issue because it's very myopic and it's very dichotomous. Mm-hmm. It's always like, okay, will China, yes or no, try and sail a million men over to Taiwan?
Yeah.
Okay, well, if you think about that logically, do they have to strike U.S. assets in Japan first? Right? Maybe. Yeah. Do they have to strike at Guam? Do they have to strike at Pearl Harbor, right? I mean, mm-hmm. you can't just take your army and, like, float it out into the ocean. That didn't work for Napoleon. It didn't work for Hitler.
Be other things. I am curious. Do you think that the international response, let's just assume a hypothetical that there was some sort of military movement by China towards Taiwan. Do you think the international response would be more swift and more united than the way it was Ukraine? Because even for all the support we gave Ukraine, a lot of it was lip service for several months.
Well, what we were doing for Ukraine was on the hop, right? It was like ex post. We had an uh-oh moment, mm-hmm. and we started shipping this stuff in quickly. Mm-hmm. I think that the Taiwan response will be, because of Ukraine in part, ex ante beforehand, right? So I imagine we're going to start seeing more in the way of arms being funneled into Taiwan. Mm-hmm. Now, will it be the sort of long-range stuff that we didn't want to give to Zelensky? Probably not. Because that would be considered by the Chinese as a real threat.
But just, again, what you say, what happens maybe Russia and Ukraine in terms of who's in the White House, same thing for China, right? Is it different?
Well, Xi Jinping, I think, is a fixed element. I mean, he...
But I mean, in terms of who's in the White House come the next presidential election, do you feel like anything in terms of policy from the United States?
No. I think this is it.
And it's been remarkable to see that one area of policy that President Biden has continued with is what Trump established in regards to China. There's been a continuation there. You've laid out a couple scenarios for us that are, I think, mildly disturbing for people who are listening or watching us right now.
Well, Tim actually put in our IB chat. He said, this is mildly terrifying.
It is.
Mildly. I'm terrified.
It was an understatement.
He was being sarcastic.
Is there anything that we can end on that's sort of optimistic about how we can avoid scenarios such as you describe?
We don't need to avoid those scenarios because Uncle Sam comes out on top. So there's your optimism. It would be nice to, but thank God we have the equipment and the inventory and the military power that we do.
But you're talking about this in the context of using force in all of these scenarios. Or is it deterrence because of the force that we have?
Strategic ambiguity, who knows, right? But I think that if you want an optimistic note, one thing we've seen from the war in Ukraine is that Uncle Sam packs a punch.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't even know the switchblade was a thing, but it is.
Yeah.
I feel like Tim is getting ready for his bunker. Hey, let me ask you, let's flip to what our audience, they obviously care about the geopolitical, but they also care about how it impacts global markets. So how do you think about 2023 with these two major big issues, whether it's Ukraine, Russia, or China? How do you think about it for the investors and what that means?
Sure. I mean, your last caller, Simon, confessed that he can't read the future. I will confess the same.
Yeah.
And I will copy his word volatility. Volatility, by its nature, is in either direction. So I think we're going to have to be slightly less passive, slightly more active, whatever we're doing. The context behind all of it is not just what's happening to supply chains in Ukraine. Mm-hmm. It's also the Fed. And the tightening cycle. So I'm one of the economists that thinks to himself, yes, we're seeing this sort of lingering ember of a belief that QE is a thing and the put is a thing. I don't think so. I think they're going to have to keep going.
All right, Ed. Well, great conversation, even if it was mildly alarming to Tim there. great insights. Ed Price, principal for geopolitical forecasting over
at Ergo.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel has become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle-market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You know, we talk about the economy in terms of charts and numbers and data and all that, but it's also, of course, about ideas and dialogue and discourse. And one of the people who has really helped to further that dialogue and discourse with some very intriguing ideas is Stephanie Kelton. Pleased to say she's joining us right now, professor of economics and public policy over at Stony Brook University and the author of the best-selling book, The Deficit Myth, which I think brought a lot of non-economists, non-wonky folks into this fray of some of your ideas. I want to start off talking about fiscal spending here and the years and years and years that we've been beaten over the head, at least in this country, with the idea that austerity was necessary. People looked at the lower interest rate environment, they say that couldn't last. They look at deficit spending running in excess of the servicing costs on that debt, and they say that couldn't last. So here we are. Those arguments have been made for years, decades. Here we are in 2022, heading to 2023. Low interest rates are gone. The other component of that argument for austerity also seems to be wavering.
Well, you're absolutely right. I mean, there are, as you rightly point out, we have been listening to the same sorts of arguments for the better part of my adult lifetime, right? It was, there's always a fiscal crisis. It's always right around the corner. You always need to rein in the deficit and get spending under control, and then you finish the sentence. And how you finish the sentence changes over time, right? Yeah. When it was the Greek debt crisis, that was the canary in the coal mine. We were going to end up like the Greeks. If it's, something happening in some other part of the world. You look at the UK more recently, it's there it is, right? There's the canary in the coal mine. So, you know, what I tried to do in the book is just to say, listen, there is a case to be made for tightly regulating the amount of money that governments commit to spending into the economy each year. But the distraction is, does it add to the deficit? And the debate that we've been having for so many decades is always about how will you pay for it? Where will you find the money? And what I tried to do in the book was to say that's the wrong question. Mm-hmm. The question we should be asking is, how will we resource it? So it's about capacity constraints. Mm-hmm. It's about inflation. And, you know, I worked in the Senate for a period of time. And I can tell you my great frustration in that job was never having heard a single member of Congress or a staffer talk about inflation risk. They'll talk about multi-trillion dollar spending bills, mm-hmm. but never bring up inflation. And for me, that was always the core of the issue.
Well, okay, so though here we are in this environment, inflation, yes, it's come down. Some saying it's peaked if you look at some of the data points, and yet it's a lot stickier at a higher level than many people are used to. So how do you think about it against what the U.S. government is doing in terms of spending or constantly raising the debt ceiling? Is that problematic in terms of the inflation picture that we are in today?
Okay, so first on the sticky question, I think that this is an open question, right? How sticky inflation is going to be, because we are seeing inflation decelerate. In the goods side, we're actually seeing prices come down, right? We've got deflationary pressures there. So we're more focused now on the service side, and I know there's a lot of attention at the Fed about what's happening with wages, and I think that's really what you're getting at when you talk about sticky. How sticky is the wage pressure? And I guess the good news there is that wage inflation is also decelerating. So
you're not worried.
Well, I'm always worried. So for me, inflation is always
She's an
the
economist.
Thing.
She's always worried.
I'm always worried. And for me, inflation is always the thing I worry most about, right? The second chapter of my book was called Think of Inflation. It was like I was begging people, will we please, you know, for once, start thinking about inflation? Because I think we got complacent with the last several years of low inflation and thinking inflation's a problem of the past.
Normal.
We'll never have to worry about it again. And if it does ever rear its head, central banks have this. They have the tool. They can dial inflation down. It's easy to handle. And I was making a really different argument.
Well, Stephanie, it seems like if we think back to the last two times we heard Fed Chair Jay Powell speak, he took policymakers to task when it came to employees and immigration. And he didn't come out and say that he recommended certain policies when it came to immigration. But one way that he could be less concerned about the employment market right now is perhaps if we do bring in highly skilled workers who can fill some of these jobs that companies are looking to fill. What would your recommendation be to policymakers to help prevent a wage price spiral as a result of companies just not being able to find workers?
Well, that's a big part of it. In April of last year, I wrote an op-ed for the New York Times, a fairly lengthy piece, and I laid out a whole suite of anti-inflation sort of tools that go beyond what the Federal Reserve can and will try to do. And one of the things that I bring up in that piece is exactly what you just mentioned, immigration policy. Mm-hmm. Badly broken. We all know it. It's been broken for so many years. So would that help to alleviate some of the labor shortages that we're talking about and hear about? Sure it would. I think the Biden administration was also on the right track when it was talking about child care. And millions of people say the reason that I'm not in the labor force today is because I'm having issues finding affordable child care. There's another good one.
Whenever we talk about labor, we always talk about it in terms of participation and obviously things like immigration and fertility rates and things like that. I haven't heard a lot of discussion about productivity and increasing productivity. Is that in and of itself kind of a myth? Is that not something that's a factor in, I guess, how we respond to these labor shortages?
Gosh, that's like if you could unlock that and solve the productivity problem, it would deal with so many other challenges that we face. And economists for a long time have said—
Are the productivity measures that we look at, are they reliable?
I think more or less. Yeah. I mean, you know, there are problems. The work's starting to question lots of data like job openings and how much, you know, is this getting right or wrong. But I think the productivity is more or less reliable. I think if we were doing more to invest in R&D, in infrastructure, in education, those are the kinds of things that boost long-term productivity. But of course, it takes time, right? Productivity is not, there's not an easy thing that you dial up to get productivity growth to shoot higher. But we can certainly do things.
We've got about a minute left here. We've talked about the I word. We've talked about the P word. Let's talk about the R word, recession. Ooh. How worried are you?
I'm worried. I'm worried, you know.
Meaning deeper, wider, longer? What are you worried about specifically?
Well, okay, so.
In just about 40 seconds. Maybe 60.
I'm worried that the stars might be aligning in such a way as to push us to a situation where recession becomes almost unavoidable. I hope it doesn't happen.
But is it touch and go?
It's touch and go.
Is it a touch and go recession? Felt it? Gone.
I would like to believe so, but that would not be my base case. I would like to think that the soft-ish landing is still, you know, that there's still reasons to be hopeful about that. Look, I think that the thing that gives me a little bit of reason for optimism is really on the fiscal side. Mm-hmm. You know, we've got the bipartisan infrastructure package, we've got the CHIPS bill, and we've got the so-called Inflation Reduction Act. Now, that has the potential to add a lot of support to the economy at just the right moment in the years ahead. So we'll see where we
are. All right, Stephanie Kelton from Stony Brook University, the author of The Deficit Myth. Thanks so much.
All right, let's talk a little bit more about the economy and economic conditions. We just had a wonderful guest in Stephanie Kelton, and we said, who can we get on to actually top her? Peter Atwater joining us right now, adjunct professor of economics over at William & Mary. He's also president of Financial Insights, a consulting firm that advises institutional investors. And really, those titles, I don't think do him justice. I mean, we talk about just sort of all the progress that's been made over the last few years in the study of behavioral economics and just social psychology when it comes to the markets. And Peter Atwater's name comes up time and time again in that research and dialogue. Peter, we talk about recessions. We talk about the economy. It's been said before that the economy really isn't a number. It is a feeling. And if a lot of people out there are looking at the egg prices in the store or looking at other things at the store, even if their wages are going up, even if everyone says there will be no recession, if they feel like things are bad, things are going to be bad, right?
Yeah, the economy just mirrors our mood, and it's a lagging indicator from my perspective. We act as we feel, and you really saw that earlier this year with gas prices. I mean, you talk about a supervillain as far as sentiment, and the connection between gas prices and consumer confidence this year has been spectacular. I mean, you could really see the pain at the pump weighing on consumer sentiment.
It's interesting, Peter, because when we've spoken about inflation over the last year, we oftentimes talk about how it hurts people at the bottom and lower ends of the income spectrum the most. They certainly feel it more because more of their disposable income does go to these discretionary costs or these non-discretionary costs. But you argue in your commentary that in 2023, we could actually see a crumbling in luxury, a crumbling at the high end, and that people couldn't see it coming. What are you talking about here?
Yeah, so when I look across the economy in terms of sentiment, what strikes me as a retrospective on 2022 is that those at the top seem to be immune from all of the pain that was being felt by those at the bottom. You know, food inflation, energy inflation, those at the top just sort of shook it off. And what you've seen is this immense overbuilding and oversupply to cater to those at the top, as if this golden era of wealth is going to go on forever. And that typically is a sign of trouble when you have this extrapolation of euphoria that seems to be everywhere, whether it's on Billionaire's Row in Manhattan or across Miami, in travel. It seems to be saturating the supply chain for those at the top.
So, Peter, if that bears out in 2023, so we see the high end also come undone and those who are paid more also feeling the pain of this economic environment, what does it mean then for a potential recession here in the United States and perhaps globally?
Well, they dominate consumption. And so I think you have to think about the implications of those at the top really struggling. And what's so interesting is that the timing stinks, because what we've seen is this, you know, demand pull in lots of hard goods and autos and in housing. And so what you could have is supply really being over generous in terms of what we're seeing starting to build on car dealer lots. And at a time when those who are most able to afford products begin to pull back. So I think we have to watch the potential for deflation, particularly at the very top.
Deflation. We haven't talked that much about that. It comes up every now and then. There are a lot of people that say, well, you know, you have to sort of look at the energy space or the commodity space and say it's not quite what it was, I think, in the 70s or 80s when we had real deflation. Some of the other areas of the economy maybe haven't sort of round trip back to some of those conditions that would provide that deflationary spiral. What is it about this time around that you think could cause that?
Well, because we've seen sort of two bullwhip effects. When suppliers pulled back on anything they possibly could at the early days of the pandemic, they cut orders, they sold inventory, and they didn't anticipate that we would see this massive inflow of capital from governments around the world and from central banks. And so what you then saw was this rush for products at a time when they were very scarce. And that's that, I think, this mismatch, this bullwhip effect created this spike in inflation, particularly in the hard goods and autos being probably the most prominent. And I think that we're on the other side of that. And I think you're likely to see the oversupply because supply chains have finally rounded and the things are coming in more naturally into ports and into supply chain at the time when those at the top begin to pull back. So it's a mismatch in the opposite direction to what we saw, you know, 12 months ago.
Peter, if we're looking ahead to 2023 and we're trying to predict whether there's going to be a recession or at least understand what the economy is going to look like, what is the most important indicator that you look at for sentiment?
It depends on the group. I mean, I look at, you know, stocks like LVMH as a great real-time proxy for the global financial elite. And that just, you know, continues to look very strong. At the same time, you move down tiers and look at something like Carnival Cruise Lines, which would be an upper middle class indicator of sentiment, planning for big trips, very expensive. You know, that looks, you know, horrendous. So that gap in confidence, I think, is really pronounced. So, you know, I think for those at the bottom, this has already been a recession. And, you know, particularly if you've had to commute, which, you know, many upper and you know, upper middle class workers haven't had to because of work from home. You know, they've experienced a lot of pain this year that others have been able to avoid just because they didn't have to commute and pay for gas.
Hey, you know, Peter, K-shaped recovery, you coined the concept, you know, coming out of the pandemic or in the pandemic, you know, the economy coming back not equally, individuals not coming back equally. Where are we when it comes to that?
So I think that what's happening behind the scenes is we're seeing a K-shaped depletion of savings. So, you know, there's a lot of averages that would show that the American consumer looks really good in terms of savings that they've got and, you know, cash on hand. But you start to dig into that, and that's heavily weighted to those at the top. And those at the bottom are depleting their savings if they have any at this point. And you're starting to see that show up in terms of the credit card debt volumes for those at the bottom. So that's that's not a great indicator.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Hey, Peter, have a great new year. Good to check in with you. Peter Atwater, of course, of Financial Insights and of William & Mary. We really appreciate your time.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ron Kruszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
Right now, we've got another voice when it comes to the equity trade and the investment trade. David Bahnsen is with us. He's Chief Investment Officer for the Bahnsen Group, and he joins us via Skype. David, nice to have you here. We've got a rally, Santa Claus rally for a day, perhaps. We'll see what happens tomorrow. When you look at the environment, can you really get a good feel of what 2023 holds for us?
I don't think in the very short term you can. It's not so much a trader's market. I think there's a lot of volatility, back and forth aspects that are more technical and much more unpredictable. Into a more intermediate term time horizon, I do believe people at least know what the questions are that need to be answered. I don't believe that the inflation story is one of great mystery. I don't believe inflation is created, first of all, by economic growth, by too many people having jobs, or by the consumer having too much optimism. Inflation is created by there being too much money supply relative to goods and services. And the production side, the supply side of the economy, has picked up dramatically. It was woefully unprepared for the COVID reopening, and we've fought through that for about a year and a half, 2 years now. But I agree very much with what Ed Yardiney said earlier. I think that the inflation aspect is going to surprise to the downside, and yet the valuations of high growth stocks remain too high historically to put a lot of optimism in indexes or the growth side, the FANG story. Therefore, we remain value investors and cash flow investors, heavy on the dividend aspect of the market.
Okay, we'll get to some of those picks in just a minute. First, though, I want to hear more about what you're thinking in the context of the Fed. If we do indeed see an inflation surprise to the downside in 2023, does that mean the Fed actually can cut rates?
Well, at some point they will, and I don't think it's particularly important. I don't think it's particularly important if they cut in Q3 versus Q4. At some point, the question is the terminal rate, not when cutting begins. And I think that terminal rate is 5% soaking wet, maybe 4.75. In other words, we're one or two more small hikes away from reaching it. And the issue the Fed has to deal with now is more messaging. How do they explain, with an inflation rate coming down, why they got so tight? And I don't think they can say what I believe, which is that asset prices were too high. They had overinflated housing. The broad inflation narrative gave them cover to really over-tighten. But we're also, let's not forget, as we talk about interest rates, going to have to deal with this balance sheet side as well. They've gotten a whopping $400 billion off of their $9 trillion balance sheet. Like so nothing. Quantitative tightening is going to be something to watch next year as well.
Yeah, I'm surprised we haven't heard a lot more folks talking about that. I mean, if you get an acceleration in that, I mean, that pretty much is good for a few more rate hikes, at least on an effective basis. I am curious, David, if you just kind of give us a sense here. When you look at market pricing, and I know market pricing over the last couple of weeks is probably distorted by the lower volume, but I'm curious as to when we start talking about a terminal rate of 5, but you still have rates for the most part under 3% on certain parts of the curve and well under 5 on the rest. And then you have an equity market that at least wants to rally here. What's the message that's being sent? I mean, what are investors betting on, even if they don't necessarily see the same reality as you?
Well, let's keep in mind that the Dow is a different story than the NASDAQ, for example. The NASDAQ right now has compounded at a grand total of 3% per year for 22 years.
Okay,
it's a stunning fact around its drawdown that it's experienced. Mm-hmm. I don't think that the large growth, high valuation, high beta side of the market is looking to rally. A lot of the darlings, the biggest cap companies, have really stubbornly refused to participate. And some of the great performers of the last couple of years have struggled even in the fourth quarter as most markets are up, Apple, Tesla, et cetera. I think it's more about a reversion to the mean, that you have value that was so disconnected from its normal relationship to growth that quality is just benefiting. And this is so similar to what we saw in 2000. Now, in 2001, 9/11 distorted a lot of this. Mm-hmm. We had a minor recession in 2002. But that's a story that I think doesn't get enough play, that you can have a recession, you can have a bear market, and still have some things in the market do well when other things are not. That's really what I expect going into 23.
But David, when you talk about some of these big tech stocks, is it fair to lump them all in one basket? You know, Apple being the same as Meta, being the same as, you know, Netflix. I mean, how do you differentiate? Because there's got to be some that are opportunities. Some of these names sell a lot of stuff and are highly profitable.
Right. All of them sell a lot of stuff and all of them are profitable, but none of them are opportunities. And I agree 100%. They're not monolithic. And it's something I've said on this show before and I've been saying for a couple of years. Even when they were all going up, they weren't all going up at the same pace. Now, this year, when you have the best performer down 30-ish and the worst performer down 70-ish, it's all pretty bad. But you're right. Those are two pretty different numbers. I think that the profit outlook and the growth outlook is different for all of them. And what's unique is that, like with Meta, for example, it's a real fundamental problem. Mm-hmm. Where with Apple and Google, I think it was just a valuation problem. Hmm. The problem is a growth catalyst. What is exactly going to give it a couple more turns in a PE ratio? I don't have the foggiest idea what would make Apple trade up 25% at this stage of the economy. In terms of technological innovation, there's nothing that's going to give it that kind of boost in 2023.
Given that we've seen a decline in some stocks that we traditionally classify as growth stocks, like a Netflix, like a Tesla, like a Meta Platforms, for example, we've seen price declines that perhaps show that there could be more value plays. Would you consider that a reason to get into some of these stocks, given that the price has declined so much that the metrics now show that they're value plays?
Again, we're
not saying growth saying Tesla by any means, by the way.
Yeah, that would be a great exception. But no, I like the idea of that. But in fact, they're not there yet. Now, what happened with Microsoft and Intel, where they became value plays out of the financial crisis? They were big dividend payers. They had 5% dividend yields back in 2009. None of these companies we're talking about, with the slight exception of Apple, pay any dividend at all. I do think they're much lower, but they're not valuations yet. Looking at the free cash flow yields, for example, there's still a ways to go. I'd love for that to happen. And a lot of those old companies that were big growth stories in the 90s, Cisco, Qualcomm, Intel, became value plays later on and ended up getting a lot of great performance out of that value level. But the FANG story is far from being there.
It's far from being there. Let's talk about, I guess, maybe what could potentially be those next growth stocks. There were a lot of folks betting, whether it was on, I guess, bets that didn't pay off, you know, like the Pelotons of the world. Others like Tesla and others seem to have maybe shown a little bit more hope and promise. Where do you see it?
Yeah, I think that Tesla has always had to rationalize its valuation on being more than a car company, but being a platform around future battery utility. And you have just a very mixed bag with the CEO. A lot of people love him. A lot of people hate him. I don't ever love the idea of someone who oversees a company worth hundreds of billions of dollars having a second job or a third job or a fourth job. Now, in fairness to him, he's done it for years. I mean, even before Twitter, he had SpaceX and these other issues. But it's just not something we can get excited about without the free cash flow generation that we want to see. But if one forced me to pick which of these growth names that has gotten hammered of a big capitalization, I think has the most upside opportunity, it would be Tesla. The other types of categories, you mentioned Peloton and some of those work from home stocks. Prior to the break, you guys were talking about Beyond Meat. These are companies that hedge funds have to go pick after if maybe they can be a private equity takeout because they have no chance of ever making real big boy money to be a major publicly traded company. Beyond Meat is down 80, 90%, and it could go to zero. But a private equity company will take it out before it goes there. Those just aren't the things we look at and what we're doing.
All right. Private equity in 2023 is a completely different conversation, but one we'll certainly have in the coming days. David Bahnsen, Chief Investment Officer at the Bahnsen Group, thanks so much for taking the time and joining us this afternoon. Really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or stream us live on YouTube and Bloomberg.com. Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier, too. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.